Thanks for downloading this Guardian podcast, brought to you in association with Squarespace. For all you need to build beautiful websites, go to squarespace.com.
The Guardian.
Thank you and welcome to Politics Weekly Live. I'm Heather Stewart, The Guardian's joint political editor. Tonight we're going to discuss a word that's suddenly become part of almost every political conversation going on in the democratic world. Populism. What caused it and what we should do about it. If 2016 was the year we had enough of experts, a year in which Britain chose Brexit and America voted for Trump, could 2017 be the year the experts fight back? Or will we see the onward march of populism through the Netherlands, France and even Germany? Are we seeing a rejection of globalisation? Or is the public just fed up with the post-crisis squeeze on living standards? Are economists and their theories partly to blame? And should we turn to them for solutions? Fortunately, joining me to discuss all this, I have a panel packed with economic experts from across the political spectrum. Anne Pettifor is an economist and director of Prime Policy Research in Macroeconomics. Rachel Reeves, sitting next to me, is the Labour MP for Leeds West, member of the Treasury Select Committee and a former Bank of England economist. Andrew Lillicoe is executive director of the consultancy Europe Economics and one of those fairly rare beasts, an economist who backed Brexit. Vince Cable is former Lib Dem business secretary in the coalition government, before which he was chief economist at Shell some years ago. And Jonathan Portes at the far end is professor of economics at King's College London. Now, in the two major political events of the past year, Brexit and the election of Donald Trump, experts and economists in particular lined up to tell voters there was only one rational option. Vote Remain and then vote Hillary Clinton. Anything else they said would be economic suicide. Instead, voters decided to give the establishment an almighty kicking by voting Leave and choosing Trump. So, how did it come to this? Anne, start us off. Do you think the roots of this go back a long way, perhaps to the financial crisis of 2008 and beyond?
I think it goes back even further. But yes, absolutely. I'm strongly of the view that the economics profession has an awful lot to answer for. If aeronautical engineers left people up in the air mid-air in aeroplanes that were likely to crash, we would blame aeronautical engineers. And when the economy crashes, the economists have to answer for that, but they didn't. And they sort of shrug their shoulders and say, nothing to do with me, Gov. But actually, economic policies, economic theory, monetary theory and fiscal theory informed the background to the crisis. The way in which we left banks to do as they please, we pretended that money is like widgets and that doing trade in money was the same as doing trade in widgets or oil or copper when it isn't. All of these ideas were deeply flawed and allowed the bankers, if you like, to run riot across the economy and then to smash it up, basically.
Jonathan, do you think that's right? Economists have to lay some of the blame for this at the door of the experts themselves, do you think?
Well, I agree with Anne in part that some branches of the economic profession bear some responsibility for the crisis. But I think, and if we're asking what caused Trump, what caused Brexit, populism, you know, we can look at the data, and it's not just economics by any means. It's clear that both in the US and the UK, you know, Trump and Brexit are very different phenomena, but we do actually have data. It's not economic data, really, about the demographics of the people voted. And it's essentially a coalition between some sections of the population who feel left behind by globalization in some sense, particularly people in the some parts of the north of England and some parts of the Rust Belt of the US. But that phenomenon goes across the country. But it's also, and equally importantly, there are lots of people who voted for Trump and Brexit who were not particularly badly off at all. In the US, on average, people who voted for Trump were slightly better off than people who voted for Clinton. And in the UK, although you were more likely to vote for Brexit if you were white, unemployed, or low-skilled, and in the north, those people are a relatively small portion of the population, and actually the votes that they needed to win came from the prosperous rest of the from the south and southeast, and from retired people. And of course, anything that says this is about a reaction against financial crisis, particularly when you look at Brexit, has to come up against the hard fact that the people who voted for Brexit overwhelmingly were people who were retired. The people who voted against Brexit were overwhelmingly young people. The people who've got screwed in this country economically by every measure over the past 10 years are young people. The people who've done best by every measure are retired people. And you have to face that fact, I think.
And Andrew, how did Boris Johnson and Michael Gove, who are quite unlikely kind of champions of, you know, anti-establishment, they're quite unlikely anti-establishment figures, how did they manage to kind of channel this sort of discontent, this feeling of you know, the system wasn't working?
Well, I think it is important. I think things are a bit different in different places. There are connections between the populism in different places, but I think they are different. And I do think, I do agree with the idea that a lot of it goes back to the financial crisis. It's not the only factor, but I think that there was a loss of faith in the system associated with the financial crisis. Also, I think that this is connected with a loss of faith in economists, because I think that economists in particular were seen as being inconsistent. So through the 1980s and the going back, the early 70s, but certainly the 80s and the 90s, economists would tell people that in coal mining firms or shipbuilders or car companies, that it was necessary for them to lose their jobs and for even their regions to experience systemic consequences where people ended up unemployed for decades and so on because of some greater merit for the broader economy.
It was a price worth paying, was it?
But suddenly, suddenly, once it was people who, not people in dirty overalls who were going to lose their jobs, but slick bankers in their suits and elderly people with their deposits, rich older people with their deposits in banks, suddenly systemic risk came to be important. And too few economists, I think, denounced the morality of this. I think there's a basic inconsistency of saying that when certain parts of the country suffer systemic consequences, that's okay. But when other parts of the country do it, that's not right. I think that that's a real problem. I think, though, that as you say, we can't just say that this is about the people against the establishment, because Michael Gove and Boris Johnson are quintessential establishment figures. I think on some of these points, there was actually a split within the establishment, which means that it was important. That's an important part of explaining what happens as well.
And Rachel, why wasn't Labour able to channel some of these forces? I mean, if people felt frustrated with Westminster and they felt the economic system wasn't working, they could have chucked out the government at the 2015 election. Why wasn't Labour able to sort of harness some of these feelings, do you think?
Well, I think that, you know, populism happens when the political system doesn't give voice to a large part of the people, and that's what has happened. And all the parties, to more or less extent, have been influenced by the economic consensus, which has been about globalisation, about free markets in goods, in services, in people. And in the end, people rejected that in the referendum. They hadn't had a chance to reject that before because there had been a consensus amongst the political parties that those things were good things. Now, of course, the Labour Party has always championed a more state involvement to regulate failed market systems. But the big picture in terms of accepting globalisation, free trade, free movement of people, all the political parties really coalesced around that. And the referendum was a chance for people to express their discontent. And I think, you know, to answer the question really of this podcast, you know, I don't think economics is the cause of populism, because there are lots of very good economists who do argue that, you know, an alternative system would work better, economists who challenge markets, economists who did see the financial crisis coming. But the economic consensus has certainly failed, and people want to move away from that. And I think really the debate is and should be about how economics and how economists can better understand and be more grounded in the realities of people's lives.
Mm. And Vince, you were one of the voices pre-2008 speaking out and saying you thought there were worries about rising levels of debt and so on. How did that economic consensus become so powerful, whether it's that the financial sectors are incredibly important and we must look after it, whether it's that free markets must be, you know, unfettered and deregulated?
Well, the simple answer is that people hadn't studied economic history, and you know, the truth is that throughout history we've had bubbles that burst and have profound consequences. The bulk of the people who voted for Brexit were elderly people who were not hurt by the crisis and had a very strong sense of nostalgia. But elections are won at the margin. And there was a narrow margin for the Brexit vote and there was a narrow margin for Trump. It's the people at the margin who were influenced by the fallout from the crisis. And it hit people in a variety of ways. Here and in the US, we became poorer. A lot of workers are poorer than they were before. Governments lost a lot of revenue, austerity and all that. The inequity, partly aggravated by monetary policy of people's assets, property prices being pumped up artificially, the rogues getting away with it, all those things. So the crisis was important in influencing a lot of people at the margin. If we look back at history, you got something similar in the interwar period. It was, I think, 3 or 4 years after the great crash that Smoot-Hawley came along with tariffs, a kind of nationalist.
This is the rise of protectionism at that time.
And that fed into initially Mussolini and then the UK retaliated. And if you go right back in history, the first big financial crisis we ever had was the South Sea bubble. And a few years after the South Sea bubble, there was terrible depression. A lot of weavers and so on lost their jobs. And you've got anti-globalization riots. This was, 300 years ago. Throughout history, we've had these bubbles bursting excess, and it's spilled over into political consequences.
But, Heather, that's also no reason to be complacent about this.
No, absolutely not.
Or indeed to be patronising to the section of the public, even if they were elderly. And a lot of people were made very insecure by the crisis. And the elderly have got children and families and grandchildren who can't get homes, who can't go to university. And so I think we need to be a little bit careful. These are major upheavals, and they're not just a response, if I may say so, Vince, to a bubble. They are a response to the failure, the failure of the global economy, which made millions of people unemployed, destroyed an awful lot of businesses, destroyed an awful lot of value. And then when the experts, the establishment came to the rescue, the banks were rescued. We found £1,000 billion overnight to bail out the banks, but we had no money to, we have not enough money to finance the NHS.
We don't disagree.
No, but I think there's another thing. I mean, I want to go back on the history, and I want to quote Carl Polanyi, who argued that when markets are allowed to detach themselves from a regulatory democracy and to operate in the stratosphere, Kraft Heinz sort of floats in and takes over a company and destroys company, it makes job losses and then floats away again. When it's so detached from regulatory democracy, people revolt, both and all classes. This is
and they want to take back control, we might say, I suppose.
Yes, exactly.
This is the reason why it's such a powerful slogan. Yeah. Vince, you talked about anti-globalisation riots there. I was going to say, let's go back a bit further than the crisis. Not quite that far, we weren't going to go back. But, if we're looking for answers, we can think about people's attitudes to globalisation going back a little bit further than 2008. So if we go back to 1999, for example, we had the first really serious anti-capitalist protests in recent memory in Seattle, featuring a ragtag band of environmentalists, trade unionists, anarchists, human rights advocates. Back then, the enemy was globalisation, as embodied by the World Trade Organization. But this version of anti-globalisation never really gained popular traction. Voters seemed to want jobs, houses and holidays, not the overthrow of capitalism, let alone anarchy. Anger about the economic system found a new form after the 2009 crash in the Occupy movement. But again, it fizzled out without really leaving a mark on the ballot box. Perhaps if we're trying to trace the causes of Brexit, we only need to go back to 2004 and the then Labour government's decision not to impose temporary controls on free movement from the new EU countries, believing their arrival would be good for the economy. And there's two strands here, anti-globalisation, which we talked about a bit, and anti-capitalism and concerns about the way that the global economy works. There was also quite a strong anti-migration strand, wasn't there, to the Brexit vote. How are those two things connected?
Well, I think it works like this.
Jonathan, yes.
What we have is capital mobility, trade mobility and labour mobility. And the idea, the free market theory is these should be allowed to move across the world without any hindrance, without any roadblocks on the way, because, the invisible hand will determine what works or what doesn't work. And none of these flows are, or not, these flows are not on the whole managed. They're not managed by democratic governments. They're left to their own devices. And so what happens, but we can't see capital flows. We can't see what's happening in the finance sector. It's A, highly secretive, and B, intangible stuff. We can see trade and we can see migrants. And they then become the targets, quite wrongly in my view, but they do, you know. It's about
so how... the visible manifestation in people's manifestation sort of daily lives, as it were. Yeah.
And what's their invisible manifestation of is the failure of government and of the public authorities to manage. And that's what people are reacting to. They've lost faith in their democratic... That's what's so terrifying about what's happening is that people have lost faith in democratic institutions, most particularly in the United States, and that is really, really scary.
And Jonathan, you're a strong advocate, aren't you, of the value of migrants and migration and of those decisions not to put controls on in the early days and so on. Could more have been done to build a public case for immigration, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. And some politicians, I mean, the Blair Brown government was sort of somewhat reticent. It did try, but not very hard. The Cameron government, of course, was far worse, as Vince knows. And in particular, there was a quite deliberate, I think, effort to shift the blame for decisions on fiscal consolidation, regardless of whether or not you think fiscal consolidation was necessary at the particular pace that it was done. There's no doubt that it had very significant effects on local services. And there was a very different, and perfectly understandable, I guess, from a purely calculating, rational political point of view, to shift the blame for those cutbacks in public services and in benefits onto two groups, benefit claimants in particular, and one group, and immigrants in the other. And it worked. You can see it in the polling. But if you go back to the demographics of the Brexit vote, and you can look at this, I mean, I think it's quite even you're talking about global as an anti-globalization vote. If you ask people whether they're for or against globalization or free trade, and look at whether that predicts how they voted on Brexit, you get a fairly loose association. If you ask them whether they're for or against immigration, you get a very, very much stronger one. That goes into that, which is the point that Anne was making, and she's right. But it goes even deeper than that. If you ask them whether they're for or against the death penalty, then this association becomes even stronger. And I think that is very revealing. But of course, the death penalty is not an issue in British politics. No one actually cares about the death penalty. Even people who are for the death penalty don't actually care about the death penalty. They don't sign petitions, go marches on it. But if you're for the death penalty, you voted for Brexit. If you're against the death penalty, you voted against Brexit.
Pretty much. What does that tell us, Vince? Do you think does it tell us there's something cultural at work here, or you talked about a kind of nostalgia?
Just the point we made before. There is a high correlation with age, and a lot of that was nostalgia for the past, a belief that the 50s and 60s were a glorious era with very low crime and so on. So, let's move on from that. It's not relevant to the discussion. I just want to make one point about globalization, which has become a kind of dirty word. But the best document, I think, that was ever published by the British government on this subject was a brilliant report which Claire Short produced at the request of Gordon Brown, shortly before the financial crisis, unfortunately, which was a very good analysis of globalization, which considered it to be overwhelmingly positive, mainly because if you look at it in the round, you know, hundreds of millions of people have been lifted out of poverty by trade. Of course, financial crisis has cast one aspect of financial globalization into a negative way, and of course there have been losers. But let's remember that very, very big context. I think the issue specifically on immigration, I think those of us who've been involved at the ballot box, and Rachel and myself are in this position, know that the public have quite ambiguous attitudes. It's the problem at the moment, and what makes it very difficult to explain and justify our current immigration position, is that we don't have unrestricted immigration. We have one group of people from India and Australia, for that matter, who are very tightly restricted, and particularly if they're from the subcontinent in Africa, enormous restrictions on visits. We have very tight immigration control for one group of people and wholly unrestricted movement for people from Eastern Europe. And that's very difficult to justify and explain on economic grounds or moral grounds or anything else. And although I'm totally anti-Brexit, I remain so. I think that one of the few conceivable good outcomes of Brexit, and I don't think there are many, is that you might actually get a more rational, non-discriminatory approach to the management of migration.
Andrew, how important do you think migration was in driving people to vote for Brexit?
Well, I think one thing to bear in mind is that there are some positive ways that economists contribute to populism, because populism is quite often the result of a small number of fairly visible and loud minorities who then attract a number of other people to side with them. Whereas because economists tend in their sort of neutral and dispassionate way to think about the good of society as a whole or the economy as a whole, they speak for silent majorities, and also for silent majorities who don't even know that they're the ones affected. So, and I think that that we shouldn't underestimate the sense in which economists, by promoting things like freedom, free trade, and reasonably open migration, and free markets, and open access to foreign takeovers, even when they're unpopular, tend to be agents of populism. But I think that that's because we're on the right side, by and large. One other thing I would say for...
We love your benign pictures.
another thing I would say on the migration issue is that I think that one aspect of the migration issue was that for many people it was the most visible aspect of the loss of sovereignty. So what happens is if you talk, say, well, there's a loss of sovereignty and it's some obscure part of financial regulation or something, people don't know why they care about that. But if your government tells you election after election that we're going to control and reduce migration to the tens of thousands or whatever, and then they find, well, but there's 10,000 extra migrants just in my town alone, then people are going to say, well, obviously, the government doesn't have control. Obviously, some foreign agency has told them what it is that we're allowed to do, and my government's no longer in control. And so I think that it's important to bear in mind that there's a close connection between the issues of immigration and sovereignty in these debates.
And Rachel, I've heard you talk before about your constituencies. Migration was quite important, wasn't it, in motivating people?
Hugely important. So the evidence of what areas voted different ways shows that the further away from London you live in England, the more likely you are voting to leave the European Union, and the greater the rate of change in your community in terms of migration in the last 5 or 10 years, the more likely you were to vote to leave. And my constituency, 200 miles north of where we are now in Leeds, that had experienced huge change. It is still a largely white working class area, but since I've been the MP, which is 7 years now, the area has changed hugely with large inflows of Eastern European workers. Now, I think Andrew's point that economists are maximising some model of utility, I don't think is entirely right and speaks for the majority. Because I think what economists, and certainly in the sort of economic model we have, are maximising GDP or growth or some function like that, rather than the welfare of its citizens. And I think that is where things have gone wrong. Because if you take an economy and let's say that the bottom 80% have £20 and the top 20% have £80, and let's say that the bottom 80% lose £5. So now, rather than having 20, they have 15. But the top 20 now, instead of having 80, have 100. So overall, the size of the economy has gone up by 5. But could anybody possibly say that is an improvement in the welfare of the economy? Of course not. And yet the economic maximising models that we use, I think are... Well, you know, we look at GDP and we say GDP is increasing, therefore we are doing well. But who is doing well? Whose recovery has it been?
Who benefits from growth? Heather, I just want to say this about immigration, because I think Jonathan, by just looking at the demographics, is actually giving us a skewed picture. There's an economic issue here too, because the increase in immigration from Eastern Europe coincided with the fall in real incomes, which began in 2004.
Whether or not you blame those migrants for that fall in real incomes.
It just so happens that it coincided with that.
At the time when we had
people,
a crash.
You know, drew conclusions.
Jonathan, do you want to answer that Rachel's point about there might be macro benefits to something, but it might still make some people worse off.
I strongly object to this bizarre idea, which I've heard it many times before, that somehow economists believe that the only objective of a welfare function is to maximise GDP. Economists have been thinking about the distributional implications and what sort of distribution of income maximises welfare and utility ever since Adam Smith. And economists have been giving advice, certainly economists have been giving advice ever since Ricardo as to the fact that not only would free trade lead to net income gains for the population as a whole, but it would lead to distributional consequences, but that it was within the power of government to ameliorate these redistributional consequences. And we've seen that in practice. We saw that between the mid-1970s and the mid-1990s, technological change, globalization, etc., led to sharp increases in inequality, which government, partly through policy and partly for other reasons, exacerbated, if anything. Then after 1995, through tax credits and other strategies, the government took a very deliberate decision to try and redistribute the results of globalization. The answer it was, and you know perfectly well, Rachel, that your constituents benefited hugely from tax credits, from increased public spending on the NHS, from money being poured into build-up councils. Now, you may say that those benefits were not communicated well enough. You may say that actually the government needed to attack that in a different way. Andrew may say that actually that was the wrong way of doing it, and actually a more market-oriented approach to developing leads would have done better, and he may well be right on that. Yeah. But it's absurd to say that economists haven't been thinking about these problems
What I said right at the beginning, Jonathan, was that you can't blame economics for populism, but the overriding and dominant macroeconomic model and the consensus, I think, does have a role to play. But also, and I totally agree with you, that the tax credits and the spending on the health service and education under the last Labour government made people in my constituency and elsewhere better off. But I think that too often we were compensating for an economic model that wasn't working by having to do all this redistribution. So if you look at the British economy, before tax credits and the tax system, we are incredibly unequal, and we become much more equal because of that. Now, that is a great thing that we have that redistribution, or certainly we did under a Labour government. But the model of capitalism that we have in this country, certainly more than others, distributes growth more unequally than elsewhere. And that is a big problem, I think. And if you say that economists care about things that are wider, and we're economists, and of course we do. But if you look at what is reported by the Office of National Statistics, or what the bank or the Treasury, Bank of England or the Treasury target, it's the macro numbers rather than, I think, what should be targeted, which is the overall welfare of the people, and looking at people as well as workers, as people who live in communities, and things that people value, I don't think are valued enough by economists. Things like belonging, like community, like place, I don't think they're valued enough by economists, and I think that people spoke, both in the US and in this country, in a reaction against the mainstream dominant economic and political model.
And I'm interested to hear, let's talk about economics for a bit. We're heading in that direction. Andy Haldane recently, the chief economist of the Bank of England, talked about economists having a Michael Fish moment. Here he is, for those who aren't old enough to remember, the man who famously missed a hurricane coming. It was almost the opposite with economists last year. They gave these dire warnings about what the consequences of Brexit would be. And so far, at least, that doesn't seem to have happened. They also, many of them, missed the crash coming. To what extent is there a kind of crisis in economics? To what extent should we be concerned about the profession of economics, what it's focused on, what it's not focused on, its failings? And you want to?
Yes, I mean, I think there is a big, big problem. I have a big issue with economists because the thing they don't talk about is money, debt and banks. And they don't teach money, debt and banks. They're not in the textbooks. I can quote a very senior international economist, whom I will protect for the sake of his reputation, who talked about money as a matter of third order importance in the economy. Adam Smith said that money was just a veil over the great wheel of circulation. So economists treat money, debt and banks as irrelevant to the real economy, which has been great for the finance sector and for the banks, because nobody is actually watching what they're doing. We have a total blind spot in economics for the finance sector. So they were able to go off and do their own thing without anybody thinking that was of importance. And that's why they could not predict the crisis.
Andrew, do you think you were giving quite a rosy glow about economists and the positive things they can do to contribute to public debate? Did economists allow themselves, in the bank and the Treasury, for example, allow themselves to be used too much by the politicians last year in the referendum campaign? Thinking about George Osborne standing up with his punishment budget that he used Treasury forecasts to mock it up. Was that a dangerous thing, do you think, for the number crunchers to do?
Well, I think there was a bit of a tendency. So two things I think they got wrong. One was there was a bit of a tendency amongst some economists to promote the idea that almost all the economists were united on this. And I don't think it was really true. I don't think that there was certainly a considerable majority of economists who thought that it would be economically bad to leave the European Union. But I don't think the majority was that much higher than it was for, than say, the case, the proportion of economists who wanted to join the euro. There was well over two-thirds of economists in the survey done by the Royal Economic Society in the late 1990s to suggest that they should join. And I think it's about 70%, 72% of economists who thought that the long-term consequences of leaving the EU would be negative economically. So I think that was one problem. A second problem, though, which is the bigger one, is that almost all of the consequences of Brexit, in my view, depend upon political judgments. So what sort of trade deals will you get with the rest of the world? What will be the implications for the way that you regulate the economy? What will happen to migration policy over the medium term? How well will the European Union react to us leaving? Will they draw together or will they become more unstable? These are all political judgments. And I think that for economists to claim that they had some neutral expertise on this and that people like, say, the Michael Gove and Boris Johnson didn't know anything about these political questions, just people didn't believe them. And why would they? These actually, in the end, are political judgments. And although there's an economic contribution, I didn't disagree with the economists about their economic models. I disagreed with them about the political assumptions which they put into them.
So the idea that there's a kind of technocratic answer to these things, that you know, you get your model and you come up with a neutral solution.
But also the models were also flawed. They were heavily biased towards trade, as if trade is vitally important and is the whole of the economy. You know, so that there was real flaws inside the economy, in particular the Treasury's model.
Let's throw it open. We're going to afterwards look forward a bit and think about what might happen next. But first of all, let's throw it open to the floor. Gentleman here, hello.
Hello. I wanted to come back to the point that Rachel Reeves was making, which does seem to me to be the point about economists sharing a blame, namely that economic commentators focus on minute changes in overall growth figures. And although the economists are right to say that economics has been well aware of the redistribution problem since Adam Smith and Ricardo, before the crisis, it was redistribution by stealth and making up for a huge increase in inequality. But the 2015 election, which is relevant to all this, had Ed Miliband focusing a good deal on the continuing problem with unequal distribution of wealth. But he wasn't allowed to do anything serious about it because it would be anti-business, which implies that it was going to upset economic growth, which would be terrible, wouldn't it? In the general context of economic commentary, it does seem to me that's rather important.
We do focus a lot, don't we, on GDP, on small movements in GDP, on, isn't that what politicians are thinking about?
But in terms of what economists actually do, look, as Rachel knows, I spent 6 years as chief economist at DWP, with literally dozens of economists working for me most of the time, sometimes over 100. And the economists and other people who were working for me did not worry about GDP at all. That is not what economists in government do. They concentrated on rather small technical micro-level interventions, which were basically about getting people into work, making them slightly better off, and you can argue, you can disagree or not with the particular interventions we chose, but we were not focused on GDP. And in fact, the big event of our annual year was, because it was very explicitly a political target set by the then Prime Minister and the then Chancellor, was the child poverty figures, which came out every year. That was a centrepiece of what DWP supposedly was there for, to help reduce poverty and improve the child poverty, because the politicians, on the advice of economists, had taken a bunch of policy measures that were supposed to help alleviate child poverty and did or didn't. Again, you can look at their. That's what economists in government actually do. They don't spend very much of their time worrying about next quarter's GDP growth because, frankly, we do know, we're not stupid, that actually trying to forecast next quarter's GDP or trying to influence it isn't a terribly productive way to spend your time.
Vince, you're an economist who turned his hand to policy.
Yes, well, I defend the role of economists in government. I think I had the second biggest number of economists after Jonathan's department.
And, it's a boast you're rarely here.
The questions that they were put to them were these. If you increase the minimum wage by X, what is the likely effects on employment? And that is a kind of question which economists are very good at answering, because they, first of all, understand the connections between things. They don't see them in isolation. And you can build simple models based on past experience as to what might happen. Providing you're modest about the consequences, this is a very healthy thing to do. I used to be a chief economist in a very big international company. And the first day I took up the job, the chairman of the managing directors came in my office and gave me an emblem with Arabic handwriting on it. And I asked him what it meant. And he said, well, if you translate it, it says, those who claim to forecast the future are lying, even if by chance they're later proved right. And what he was basically saying is, what we don't want from you are forecasts that have no underlying substance. What we want from you are interesting, logical scenarios about the future. So my answer to him was, OK, fine, but you want to build a refinery in China or a gas terminal in Nigeria, and 20, 30 years' time it will still be there. What assumptions do we have to make about the future? Because you can't just stagger around in the dark. You have to have a set of assumptions. Providing you're clear and open and honest about the assumptions you're making, economists don't just have a role, they have a duty to set out what is a plausible way forward. And although I think Osborne over-egged the arguments about Brexit, it was totally legitimate to look at the Treasury modelling about what might happen. And actually, what they did predict is actually correct. I mean, the main argument was we'd get a shock. And the shock happened. You know, we've had an 18%, was it, devaluation, trade weighted, something like that, the biggest devaluation since the war. And it's having consequences. Why is Kraft put in a bid for Unilever? Because the assets are 80% cheaper. Yeah. So, you know, the warning that there would be consequences was totally justified and logical.
But hang on, Kraft took over Cadbury's before Brexit and then made people redundant and didn't honour their promises. So that the ability to take over our companies isn't entirely because of Brexit.
No, of course it's not entirely, but it's the environment's changed.
I can see a lady in the middle here with a yeah, here we go.
Thank you. My question is, if we were to adopt a policy of universal income, would that have the effect of dampening down populism?
Rachel, do you want to?
So I think the idea of a universal basic income is attractive on the surface, but I do worry about the implications of it. First of all, so this is about saying that everybody, irrespective of what they do and what their needs are, would be given, say, £8,000 a year. Now, you know, whether it's affordable or not, I have some moral issues with it. Because what gives our life value and meaning? It's our families, our communities, but also, for people of working age, it is work as well. And all the evidence suggests that people are happier, have greater confidence, their health is better if they are working. And I think to say that everybody, irrespective of their needs and their job search or whatever, is given £8,000, well, first of all, some people need a lot more than that because they may have a disability or caring responsibilities. But also, we're suggesting that work somehow isn't important and isn't something that we should be striving to do. Now, the Labour Party was formed as the party of work. We think that there is something intrinsically valuable about work. Now, work needs to be meaningful and people need to have some powers at work to influence the work they do and have opportunities at work. But I think that work is incredibly important for all of us. I would also say that, let's say that at the moment we had a universal basic income and we had a Conservative government like we do today. I really worry that places in the country could just be totally written off and it could be okay because we've got a universal basic income, so that area, you know, it doesn't matter if there's not work because everybody has an income. I just don't think that's good enough. I think that we need to be creating good, high-quality, well-paid jobs across the country, and we need to ensure that people have the skills and the confidence to go and get those jobs. But I think at a post-work age, I think, first of all, there's always going to be a need for people doing meaningful work, but also a post-work age, I think, is not a utopian. I think it's a dis-utopian world.
Is anyone a fan?
No, it's an attempt to provide a simple solution to a very complex set of problems. And if it's pitched at a generous level, completely unaffordable, and if it's pitched at an affordable level, it will produce vast numbers of losers and anomalies. The Swiss argued this in a referendum. I mean, the danger of being captive to simple ideas. My former colleague in the coalition, Ian Dunkard-Smith, believed in something called universal credit, which, I mean, in a way is the same idea in a slightly more British way.
By the way, Vincent voted for that every single time we voted on it in Parliament. But
you know, the minute you run into something really complicated like housing benefit, which varies from place to place, mm-hmm. the idea of a universal benefit just collapses.
I think that brings us on quite nicely to look forward, if we look forward a bit now and think about what happens next. And Rachel, that's right, isn't it, that politics has changed quite significantly with the two referendums. Perhaps they were just, with the Scottish referendum and the Brexit referendum, perhaps they were just expressions of things that were already, changes that were already happening. But they do seem to have highlighted divides and also cultural as well as economic or political issues, is that?
How does Labour
respond to that?
So I think there's two things. There's first of all the problems which I have tried to articulate, but others will disagree with the economic model. Mm-hmm. But then even if people accept the economic risks of leaving the United Kingdom in terms of the Scottish referendum or leaving the European Union with regards to our most recent referendum, even if you accepted all of those, there might be other reasons why you think it is the right thing to do. So I don't mind if GDP is a bit lower, I don't mind if unemployment's a bit higher, I want to leave the European Union because I want to take back control over borders, want greater sovereignty. And I think, there's certainly these cultural issues and identity politics that Vince has articulated, but there's also this sense of a democratic deficit, which I think is very real. And Vince said, he and I both campaigned strongly to remain in the EU, but Vince says that, one good thing that might happen out of this is that we have a more sensible approach on immigration. I think also, if one good thing comes out of this, is that people will have more say over the rules that govern our country. And people clearly wanted that degree of control.
Because more decisions will be made at Westminster instead of in Brussels or Strasbourg or elsewhere.
Yes, and people, I think there's a real desire for that, and not just for Westminster to take decisions, but to have decisions made in local communities and regions. I think that there is a democratic deficit, both with too many decisions taken in Westminster and Whitehall, and with too many decisions taken in Brussels. And even if that may have better economic outcomes, if there's a democratic deficit, if you take China, China might be growing very strongly, but would we want to live in China? Maybe not, because they don't actually have much say. And I think people here as well, I don't want to compare us to China, but people want to have more say over the rules that govern their lives. And at the moment, a lot of people feel they don't have that control, and that is something that the Leave campaign really tapped into.
Jonathan, does that make sense to you, the idea of greater control and these sort of cultural issues that are hard for economists to get their hands around, but that do seem to influence the way people feel about the world?
Well, I mean, I have go some way along with what Rachel said, but I think that it's that's quite an optimistic perspective. My guess is that people will actually realise that they have not got back very much in the way of control over things that actually affect their lives. They'll discover that if we do in fact adopt a new immigration system, first of all, it will not be the immigration system Vince wants, which is an equal, non-discriminatory one, which is actually lets more people from India or Africa or Australia come here. It will be the opposite. More to the point, people will discover that choking off the flow of Eastern European migrants does not help Leeds West very much at all.
But it'll be the immigration system that people vote for rather than one that we have no say over. So for the last however many general elections, no one's had a choice about whether they want to have immigration from the European Union. We've just been told that is the consequence of being in the European Union, and no party was willing to challenge that. So it may be the case in the future that we have Vince's system, if Vince can persuade enough people that is the right system to have. So to that extent, you will have control. At what cost? I understand that, and that's why I wanted to stay in the European Union. But people didn't have a choice before, and too much was being done to people without their consent, and people rebelled and reacted against that.
As you know, Rachel, the vast majority of what has been done to people in Leeds West in the last 30 years has been entirely with their consent, if by consent you mean that it has been decided by the Westminster Parliament. The vast majority of things that affect people in Leeds West and in every other constituency in the country, the vast majority of things that are good about Britain and that are bad about Britain in policy terms are things that are determined by our own government. The state of the education system, the redistributive or otherwise nature of the tax credit and benefit system, the whether or not we have an industrial policy and whether or not it works, the decision, good or bad, to allow manufacturing and coal mining in areas of the north to disappear, and then to address them with policies which did or didn't work. All of those were primarily decisions taken by a Westminster government, a Westminster Parliament elected by us. And so the idea that because now the voters of Leeds West, that you will be able to have a vote on immigration policy, maybe once a parliament. Actually, of course, you don't have a vote on immigration policy, but it's almost entirely made by the Home Secretary through secondary legislation. The idea this will, in some sense, restore control over people's lives, I think, is hopelessly optimistic. The question I ask is, what will happen when people realise this? And I don't know the answer to that.
But what you're suggesting, Jonathan, you can say that people have made the wrong decision, but people, when confronted with the choice and the arguments of both campaigns, made a decision that despite the warnings that you and myself and others gave, they wanted to leave. Now, 2 days before the referendum, I was at a workplace in my constituency and I made the arguments about the risks and the jobs. And I reminded the people there that before the financial crisis, that business employed 750 people. It fell to 500 and it was now back at 800. I said, you know what happens when the economy turns sour. It's jobs in places like this that disappear. And they said, who cares? All the jobs here are going to foreigners anyway. Now, that is their feeling. And actually, you look at them, talk to the management, you say, well, actually, we are recruiting, the vast majority of our employees now from Eastern Europe because, for a variety of reasons.
Because they're cheaper.
Because they are more highly motivated, more highly skilled. But instead of training up the local people in the community like businesses should do, they import people for cheaper. And people have rebelled against that. And I think there is a complacency in economics, Jonathan, that says, look at the evidence. And people in my constituency and elsewhere, because it's not just the people of Leeds West who voted against being a member of the European Union, people said, it is not working well enough for us. Average earnings in my constituency are £19,000 a year. It's all well and good for us to say, well, you're taking a big risk. What about jobs? What about growth? Well, they say, well, it's a risk I'm willing to take because the economy is not working for me and for my family. And I think we've got to better understand, why there is such a disconnect between, some parts of country and the other, and some people with one level of education and people without university education who are more likely to vote leave. And I do think, who's responsible for populism? I think it is in part the responsibility of the political and the economic establishment and too much complacency about how the economy works for people.
Andrew, you've been waiting to get in.
Yeah, so I think we should bear in mind something here, which is that in the UK, the main populist groups, UKIP and the Corbynites, are doing very badly. And they're doing very badly in the polls. The Conservatives, led by an ultra small C Conservative leader, are 18 points ahead. So I think that what has happened is that whereas in other parts of the world, people at some point in Greece, in even in the Netherlands, perhaps in France in a few weeks' time, in Spain, have felt that they despaired of the political system and moved to populist parties, I think that the Brexit voters drawn the sting from that. And what we have is actually the reinforcing, as has happened at times in the past, of the position of the most conservative, the most establishment of the political parties in the system.
Probably because they've adopted some of the language and some of the sort of poses of UKIP, though, isn't it? We're going to have a red, white and blue Brexit and we're going to prioritise control of immigration over... Yeah. GDP growth or whatever else. I mean, it's
that's not what they've said. No, I don't think that's what they said at all. Absolutely, they've co-opted. But I mean, that always happens with centrist parties. Establishment parties always co-opt some of the ideas of the that work with people. And why shouldn't they? They're trying to appeal to voters, and this is what the voters want. So I think it's a you should distinguish between things which people want in a democracy and populist ideas. I don't think that they're exactly the same thing.
Anne?
I think what is happening, and it's not an identity politics issue, it's an economic issue fundamentally. And I think what we have to do is realise what's happening here is happening in the United States, is happening in France, is happening in Hungary, is happening in Russia, is happening in India. And this is a rise in nationalism. And it's a rise in, it's looking to the nation for protection from forces beyond the control of the nation, apparently. So, you know, Donald Trump is going to build a wall and protect American workers from Mexican workers. This is his promise. And now we may mock at that and laugh at it, but in truth, people want to be protected. And economists are saying, no, it's not good for you to be protected. Free markets, free trade is jolly good because it reduces prices, including, if I may say so, Jonathan, the price of labour, which is what we expect markets to do. We increase the supply of labour, you lower the price of labour.
And the
evidence in Britain is that real earnings, real pay has fallen systematically since 2004. People are poorer than they were. Yeah. And you know, it's a big issue. It's not a cultural issue. It's not an identity issue. It's an economic issue. But it's happened in the United States. It's happening in India. It's happening in France. And people are angry, and they're hoping that the nation, and we're therefore getting what I think is quite often an ugly manifestation of A, nationalism, and even fascism. And we had this in the 1930s, after the 1929 crisis. People wanted to be protected from those forces they were told were beyond their control, the forces of globalization or financial liberalization. Everybody said, you know, it's nothing to do with the government. You know, if Kraft want to take over your company and get rid of all the jobs in your company, that's tough. That's the market. And the market decides, not the government. You know, and what I think it is true that the government extraordinarily has an 18-point lead in the opinion polls. And yet Mrs. May is saying, nothing to do with me. If PSA come and take over Opel and take all the jobs away from Vauxhall, what is she going to do? What can she do?
Although she strikes a rather different pose, doesn't she? She does talk about the good that government can do, about intervention.
Yes, there's a lot of talk.
She seems to be far less laissez-faire than George Osborne.
If I just might finish quickly, that she's talking about, you know, taking back control, but she's also talking about being global Britain. In other words, we're not going to stop any of that happening. We're going to be as global as we were before, and we're going to take back control. And that is so, you know, contradictory, and is going to reveal itself as such.
I was going to say, we'll get a sense, won't we, further through the Brexit negotiations of exactly, you know, at the moment it's possible to say that you'll do all of those things at once, but that will become increasingly difficult as we find out what kind of Brexit deal we're going to get, won't it? And you paint us an upbeat picture. We've talked about some of the potential, even the strong Remainers have talked about some of the potential benefits of leaving. And you talked about the Brexit vote as being a rejection of the economic status quo. What changes can we make to Britain's economic model as a result of Brexit? What will we be able to do in economic policy making terms that we couldn't do before?
Well, there's all kinds of things we will be able to do. Mm-hmm. What we ought to do is rather different from the things that we might.
What ought we to do?
Well, I think what we ought to do is to we ought to seek to make as many international new free trade agreements as we possibly can, particularly with large economies like the US or Japan or who knows, even China at some point. We see where we get with India, but I'm more doubtful about that. I think the US and the Japanese are easier for us to get. And of course, we'll need to have as intimate a deal with the European Union as we can secure from them. It won't be as intimate as the deal that we've had in the past, but I'm optimistic that we should be able to get a close deal with them. We need to be thinking of some alternative geopolitical partnership. One of the reasons that I think that we've ended up leaving the European Union is that the potential for us, although we benefited greatly from that particular geopolitical partnership for many decades, its opportunities had been exhausted. So as you were expanding the European Union to include more and more countries from the former communist states and so on, eventually you get there's all the ones that you can include that you've included. As you strip away tariffs, once there are no tariffs left, then there's no further you can go. As you convert your partners to a philosophy based around limited state aid and pro-competition and so on, you've come to an end of that. I think that we should be going out and finding new countries to do new arrangements with. I favour, in the first instance, looking for a deal with the Canadians and Australians and New Zealanders. Those would be my first priority, perhaps extending out to include others after some decades, probably. It much the same way that the European Union operated for some decades and then eventually expanded out. So that would be a kind of imaginative thing. I think that we should also take the opportunity of greater regulatory flexibility within the UK to try to make it to take advantage of the way in which that allows us to promote tomorrow's technologies. So the European Union had a ratchet process within it, which was very, which meant that once something was in place, it was very hard to undo anything. That's good if you know what the best thing is that you want to do. So if you're just saying, well, we want to strip away non-tariff barriers, then you don't want the forces of reaction mobilising once you've finally got in place. But tomorrow's challenges, what to do about the sharing economy, what to do about green technologies, the commercial exploitation of space, even more mundane things like vaping, the European Union's much less good at knowing exactly what the best thing to do is. So I think we have the opportunity to do regulatory experiments in these areas and work out what the cutting edge, the best practice is in those ways, which should allow us, if things go well, to become world leaders in the regulation of those new tomorrow's sectors and perhaps attract them to base themselves in the UK in the future.
But that's a bit different from a kind of bonfire of red tape, or, you know, it's a little bit different from
none
that.
None of that's going to happen.
I think many of the things,
both on the upside and the downside, I never believed there was going to be any huge bonfire of regulation. I never believed we were going to have some enormous gains from the reduced contribution. Most of the monies that we send to the EU, we're going to be spending on something anyway. I never thought we would make an enormous impact on immigration as a consequence of leaving the EU. I know that Jonathan fears that that will be a consequence, but I'm skeptical that that will really happen. So I think that those aren't the kinds of things which that this thing was really going to produce for us.
Although that does then raise questions about how voters will feel when they don't get that 350 million quid a week for the NHS, when they don't get the reduction in migration, or rather we take back control of it, but we let as many people in as we did before, but maybe slightly different people. There's a risk, isn't there, that of public dissatisfaction if it doesn't work as well as...
They're making some choices, right? So if we choose to spend that 10 billion a year or whatever on projects in the UK, and we waste them just as effectively in the UK as as the European Union would have wasted them for us, at least we've wasted
them. But it'll be our waste, yes.
Yes, it'll be our waste. And if we choose to, I think one of the, on the migration point, I think the politicians for far too long were able to make promises which they knew they weren't going to have to keep
on immigration. Because it was a sort of get out of jail and free card.
Exactly, and I think it's a terrible mistake to think that the point on immigration of leaving the European Union is that you then enforce the stupid promises which you should never have made. I think that will force politicians to make different and more realistic promises in the future. And I think that should be one of the things that we expect of them.
Mm. Jonathan, what do you think?
I mean, I agree pretty much with everything Andrew said. I just think he's being extremely, you know, in terms of in
the
theory.
The oughts.
In terms of the oughts. Yeah. Disagreeing with a lot of what Andrew said in terms of what many economists would like to see happen, I'm somewhat more pessimistic. Both on the prospects for trade deals, but also on the prospects for us being able to make good policy domestically, because I think this the idea that taking back control from Brussels to Westminster, which is what has happened to Westminster and Whitehall, necessarily leads to an improvement in the quality of policy, nor towards the quality of the regulation, the quality of how we spend money. It might, in some cases, there are clearly things we could do better. To take one example, which Andrew didn't mention, but if we can't do better than the bloody common agricultural policy...
Well, I was going to say, Britain's
really,
moaned about that for years, hasn't
really
it, and
just
how irrational it is.
Give up as a country entirely.
Yeah.
So there's a gain.
But on some other things,
I'm more sceptical, and I do go back to the... You know, and this is what worries me about what I think, frankly, is some of the snake oil being sold. I won't necessarily put Anne and Rachel in that category, but it's not that far off. The snake oil, the idea that limiting immigration is going to somehow do something for wages. You know, the facts are, actually, in the last year or so, since immigration has gone back up to the highest ever level, wages have begun to rise again, and they've risen higher for lower paid workers than they have for
yeah, that's down to the living wage, yes.
Lower, but it's actually happened at deciles higher than that, and the people who've done worst, of course, are people at the top. Since immigration has gone up to the to records, people have done worst as
are
it happens.
Are you really saying that in the last 12 years that the people at the bottom have done better than the people at the top?
You know, how are people at the bottom doing at the moment? Their wages have been stagnant for 10 or 12 years. There are more people than ever, 800,000 people on zero-hour contracts, people working part-time who want to be working full-time. You know, we've got home ownership falling to record lows because people just cannot afford to get on the housing ladder. You know, this is my problem about the complacency. Yeah. You know, the reality of lives for people on low incomes and low to middle incomes is incredibly tough. Now, I'm not saying that immigrants are the cause of all problems.
No.
I'm not a fool, right? Yeah. But I do know that things are pretty tough at the bottom. And when an employer can bring in an unlimited number of low-skilled workers and undercut people who are already here, that, of course, is going to put downward pressure on wages. Now, you're an economist. You know, the first thing you did was demand and supply curves. If you don't think that a huge number of migrant workers, low-skilled, are going to have any impact on wages. You know, I think you should just go back to that first economic lesson you did.
Let me respond to that quickly. First of all, I'm very surprised to hear an economist like Rachel say, as you know, Rachel, immigration and trade affect demand and supply, and there is no necessary reason that immigration depresses wages. And and the econometric evidence says, as you both know, that it doesn't.
Let's throw it open for a few questions for the last few minutes. A gentleman over here in a check shirt.
Pre the recession in 2008, Adam Greenspan talked a lot about workers' insecurity being a kind of key cause for economic growth. I was just wondering how that correlates, well, in sort of modern times from a UK perspective, and what the kind of role of workers' rights and workers' security will be in the future.
Vince, do you have thoughts on that?
Certainly in the 5 years I was in government, there was enormous pressure from my coalition colleagues to get rid of some of those job protections. And, you know, by and large, they have been maintained here. I mean, you're quite... But I think what's happening is that the whole, you know, labour force is changing. You no longer have, you know, long-term settled employment, whether it's in white-collar or blue-collar work. It's much more flexible and... The issue we had to confront, and Rachel will know because I think she was opposite me on that occasion, was what you do about zero-hour contracts, which are, I think, a good example of this new insecurity. When we surveyed it, what we found was, for some people, this was absolutely dreadful. I mean, they were insecure, their family lives were disrupted. But for very large numbers of other people, this kind of take it and leave it type of employment suited them fine. You know, students working part-time, elderly people aged 65 who wanted to top up their pensions. A lot of people with, you know, juggling family responsibility wanted to be able to say, well, we don't particularly want to turn up to work today. So it was actually quite a difficult issue to deal with when you actually looked at the evidence as opposed to the kind of heated rhetoric around it. And we did bring in some modest restrictions on some of the extreme abuses. But I think that the central point I'm trying to make is that this new kind of labour force, it is horrible for many people, and it is completely, destroying their sense of worth and their sense of security. But for others who are more entrepreneurial and more flexible, it's a big opportunity. And that's why I don't think politically people have responded to this phenomenon in quite the way that, you know, Rachel and perhaps I would have hoped, that a lot of
Rachel,
people
did you
have
want
embraced
to say something about self-employment, which is another big change, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, so in 2012, there were 1.5 million more people working in the public sector than there were people who were self-employed. And within a decade, so by 2022, the Office of Budget Responsibility say that there'll be an equal number of people self-employed compared with working in the whole of the public sector. That's a huge huge growth in self-employment and a fall in the number of people who work in the public sector. Now, some of those people who are self-employed are entrepreneurs, they're going to be the big businesses of the future and wealth creators. A lot of the self-employed are working for Uber, working for Deliveroo, are working in the gig economy. They are less likely to have pensions, less likely to be able to get a mortgage. They have no employment protections if they fall ill or if they become pregnant or if they are unable to work because of disability. And this is a real challenge, I think, for policymakers about how to ensure that people who are not genuinely self-employed or bogusly self-employed are given the rights that they are entitled to, but also those people who want to work as self-employed and also have access to things like pension savings, being able to get a rental agreement on a flat, be able to get a mortgage in the future. Because if the economy is changing and the world of work is changing, policymakers so far haven't kept up, and that needs to change. But also we need to ensure that people have the right that should be afforded to them if they are employees.
And actually, Theresa May has commissioned a review, hasn't she, at the moment, which is looking into the changing world of work and how regulations should change to deal with that.
We'll see whether she walks the walk or talks the talk.
Indeed. Gentleman here.
We've got a demographic change that is occurring both in the West and UK. Aging population, reliance on pensions. Some economists have argued that Europe needs 50,000 new immigrants and the UK needs 5 million new immigrants. I don't want to touch on the immigration issue. What I want to sort of touch on is what Mr. Lavrov said a couple of days ago. Are we living in the post-West phenomena?
That's a big one. Andrew?
Are we living in the post-West era? I think that we are living in an era in which many of the assumptions of the immediate post-Cold World post-war era have become obsolete, and including some of the institutions. So that, I think, is one of the things going on with Trump, that NAFTA, he's raising questions about NAFTA and NATO and the IMF and talking about downgrading the UN, and of course you have Brexit and the UK being part of that. So I do think that there is a sense in which some of the arrangements that we'd had aren't right for today's power structures in the world. It's likely to be that we're going to have more involvement for China and India in institutions like the IMF in the future. I think that that's probably true, reflecting the changed balance of power in the world. On the question of the role of demographics, I think that that's mainly a good news story, that we're living a lot longer. I think it will also be associated with very considerable increases in working life. So many of the assumptions that people made about how long longevity would create some kind of demographic time bomb seemed to me to be based around the rather naive idea that people are going to continue to retire at 55 or something. I think that people will work much later, and because of tomorrow's jobs, there'll be some changes in the employment market, including some of those areas in the gig economy and so on, which will allow them to work much later in life. And so I think that that's by and large positive. And one other thing I would say is, the situation in different parts of Europe demographically are very, very different. So if you think about Germany or Italy, they would have considerable contractions in their population without very large amounts of immigration. And it isn't true in anything like the same way for the UK. Our dependence on getting in additional immigration, although there are all kinds of upsides to us getting in immigration, we don't have that same kind of desperate need to get immigrants in to pay for our pensioners that the Germans and the Italians do.
We can take one more, I think. Lady there.
My question is about the tyranny of what's already here and statistics. So having studied economics at university, I came away with a sense that actually economists have simply tried to kind of bolster their own reputation and become like mathematicians or physicists, stuffing equations with ever more complicated like integration derivatives. And I don't say this because I hated it. Instead of looking kind of forward and having economic and political innovation, you kind of hide behind excuses of, oh, you know, but we've lifted so many people out of poverty. Capitalism has done wonders. But, you know, why can't we innovate and think of an economic model that lifts people out of poverty and doesn't increase wealth inequality? Why can't we think of a political model that does empower people rather than leaving them so confused that they just tune out and say, actually, do you know what? I'm better off not paying attention. I'll leave other people to do it.
Good question. Jonathan, do you fancy that one? Are you just hiding behind a load of old numbers?
The economic model that lifted quite literally hundreds of millions of people out of poverty in China especially, but also other developing countries, India, some parts of Africa and so on, doesn't have anything in particular to do with complicated equations or particularly fancy economic models. It has to do with a combination of economic insights that we got from Ricardo and Smith a couple of hundred years ago, combined with insights from political economy about what sort of institutions, what government needs to do to create and manage markets that more or less work. So this is not, the sophisticated modern mathematical economics that you may have been taught. Yet, was it perfect? Of course it wasn't. Did it increase wealth inequality in some respects? Yes. Did it have negative consequences for some groups, communities, and groups of people here in the West at the same time as it had positive consequences for many of the rest of us here? Yes. But that is that is how life works. And economists are best. What economists do, I still think, is, and yes, Anne's right, I am basically a microeconomist, but I do think the job of economists is, in government, is primarily to try and painstakingly explain to politicians and hence to commentators in the public, first of all, some of those fairly simple insights that we get from economics about resource allocation, about opportunity cost, things like that, and at the same time to do the sort of careful and detailed empirical work that economists do as to which microeconomic interventions, which welfare-to-work programs work best, which poverty reduction programs work best. Does providing free mosquito bed nets in Kenya actually reduce malaria or not? Something about which literally dozens and dozens of papers have been published in the last 10 years, and so things which have really changed people's lives. That's what we're supposed to be doing and what most of us try and do most of the time.
So I think that a key thing to understand about some of the mathematics done in economics is that when it's good, it will produce you an insight which you can then present non-mathematically. It helps. It's a sort of shortcut of reasoning, so that then you see, once you see the final answer, you see in non-mathematical terms why it works. And I always try to encourage my colleagues when they're presenting mathematical results to say what the intuition is. What does it really mean? And so, and that's one aspect. A second thing I say is, I don't think we've criticised various aspects of economics quite a bit this evening, and why shouldn't you? But I don't think one should underestimate the extent to which economics has contributed to enormous improvements in human welfare. Oh, lots of other things have done that, political theory and so on as well. But it's not just, when you say, taking hundreds of millions of people out of poverty, that's not just a number. That's hundreds of millions of people who aren't in poverty. And that's something really concrete. And economists have assisted in the management of economies. Economic volatility has been markedly lower in the period in which people developed theories about macroeconomic management, central banks, interest rate control and fiscal policy and so on. It's just been, we don't get these things perfect, and we can do better, and we should always try to do better. But that doesn't mean that we don't contribute to anything valuable as things stand.
And briefly, we're going to
just a second. There's different kinds of economists, and I haven't got the parallel right exactly, but it's as if you've got bricklayers, building buildings, but no architects and no urban planners. And without the urban planners, without the macroeconomists and the architects, the builder's going to get things wrong. But he's going to be very good at putting one brick on top of another. So that's the problem with economics. It's dominated by microeconomists who use microeconomic reasoning, extrapolate that for macroeconomic outcomes. And that's what's wrong with micro becomes incredibly micro, really. And it's about that's what's missing in economics, is those other dimensions.
I abandoned
professional economics for politics, but actually I speak up very strongly in support of professional economics. I was taught economics, amongst others, by a man called Stone, who became a Nobel Prize winner, and he created the first true model of the British economy. And what he was trying to do, and what models do, they tell you about the past and why, if you do A, B happens. If the government increases taxes and doesn't do anything else, that will have all kind of complicated effects. But you need to have a structure in order to trace what these are. Now, it may well be that people have become too clever by half and they've become obsessed by advanced mathematics. But the basic idea of building models which help to explain why certain things happen and how they interact with each other is a perfectly sensible and legitimate thing for economics to do. And I do worry that that there's a kind of philistinism now developing. Economics is a useful discipline. We shouldn't overstate its benefits, but it is important. And, you know, let's please not throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Rachel, last word?
Yes, so I think that the lady who spoke about her experience of university is right. And I think, you know, Jonathan and Vince's defence of economics is good, but it's probably not that relatable to your course. My experience, the more you study economics, the more mathematical it comes, and the less you evaluate the models and the assumptions underpinning the models and the equations that you're looking at. And I do worry that that has spilled over into the economics profession, whether that's in the public or private sector. And I think we do need to get back to some of the basics of economics, and also to learning more about our economic history, from which I think we could learn a lot today. So I think that there is a real problem with economics teaching, that it needs to be more grounded in that economic history, but also in the assumptions and the moral philosophy that underpins some of the things that you're learning.
That's a very nice note on which to end, I think. That's all we have time for tonight. Please subscribe to Politics Weekly wherever you get your podcast from. You can follow all the political coverage from me and the team at theguardian.com/politics. My thanks to Rachel Reeves, Vince Cable, Anne Pettipur, Andrew Lillico and Jonathan Portis. The producers were Rebecca Ashton and Phil Maynard. I'm Heather Stewart. Thanks for listening.